wife and I were attending Ambassador College in Pasadena, we sometimes heard ministers say these words, "Salvation is education. Salvation is education." When you understand that we're talking about education in God's way of life, that's definitely a true statement. And if it's true, then this past week is one of the most hands-on lessons that God gives us every year. Every time we have to stop and think and realize that we need to be more careful than usual, especially when we're not in our own homes, which has, those homes have had all the leavening removed from them, we have to remember to avoid consuming anything that has leaven in it. And we are reinforcing some important lessons, some important spiritual lessons, that sin is all around us. It's easy to forget or lose focus and slip. I know in talking to many members over the years, I've even heard of people who just, they're out working and they thought about how hungry they were and, oh, it's just about lunchtime. Well, there's one of those fast food places over there and I'll just get, you know, just a simple meal, just a basic burger and fries and a drink. And halfway through the burger, they realize, oh, no, what am I doing? It's the days of unleavened bread. Or maybe you've had the experience of searching through a remote section of your freezer for something for dinner, and you notice there's a bag of something in there that you thought was ground up walnuts. And you pull it out, and it's breadcrumbs. And it's been there the whole time, and this is day six. Worse, you find it 3 days after the days of unleavened bread are already over. And it was there the whole time. And I'm sure most of us have had similar experiences. It's a lesson. Another connection I'd like to focus on for this sermon today is, and it's one I've noted this year, especially as I've been watching, it's the current subject being covered in Foundation Institute online program, The Conquest of Canaan. That's very topical to this time of year. It's taught by Ken Giese, one of the adjunct instructors for FI. That is, it's not his full-time job. He has other responsibilities, including, in this case, his main job is to pastor the congregations in Fort Worth, Texas, and Tulsa, Oklahoma. If you've listened to any of the three classes that have been posted so far, you might pick up on the fact that he's actually covering material connected to the Spring Holy Days in the early part of the book. It's brief in the reference early in the book of Joshua, but it is there. And I'm sure most of the sermons that you've heard over the years at this time of year that dealt with the Israelites and their example were usually about their time in slavery in Egypt, maybe about the 10 plagues on Egypt, about Moses meeting God at the burning bush leading up to all of that, about the first Passover eventually and the death of the Egyptian firstborn, which we know was the 10th plague, about Israel leaving Egypt, crossing the Red Sea, Israel before Mount Sinai, camping there for about a year or a little more, Israel and the golden calf while they were in front of Mount Sinai, Israel in the wilderness for 40 years when they refused to enter the promised land, the first time God instructed them to, Israel murmuring off and on during the entire 40 years, testing Moses' patience and God's in the process. We've heard lots of material about that. All of it loaded with lessons for us, as Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 10, I won't turn there, but you've read it many times, about these things happen to them for examples for us. And yes, this is a good time of year to refresh our memories and relearn some lessons. Paul knew that, and he wrote about Israel's example when he wrote that first letter to Corinth, which we believe he did during the days of unleavened bread. What I want to do today is to take some time, as we're about to conclude keeping this special week of time for 2021, moving toward that time when Mr. Slagle can go buy some chocolate chip cookies and eat as many as his wife will let him tonight. I just got a thumbs up from Mrs. and a dirty look directed at him. Anyway, to take some time to look at some of the same material that Mr. Giese's covering in the FI online classes right now about the period of the conquest of Canaan, about the example of the Israelites under the leadership, not of Moses today, but under the leadership of Joshua, because I think there are lessons to learn there too. I'm sure there have been some sermons given on the book of Joshua connected to the Spring Holy Days, even though most tie into Moses. I imagine I've heard some going back far enough, and maybe I've given one or two somewhere in the last 48 years in the ministry. But I wonder if most of them may be keyed on the famous phrase we associate with Joshua. If I were to ask you to write it down in your notes, if you're keeping track by writing notes today, I bet most of you could do it without ever even turning there, or maybe not even knowing exactly the chapter and verse. It appears four times in the very first chapter of the book of Joshua, and you know the phrase, "Be strong and of a good courage," that Joshua was encouraged by God to carry out his duties and responsibilities and instructions, and it's something we're all familiar with. Now, make no mistake, that's a powerful message, and one that resonates throughout the book. But even that famous phrase didn't appear for the first time in the book of Joshua. In fact, it appears three times in Deuteronomy chapter 31. I won't turn there either, but you can look it up in verses 6 and 7 and 13 of Deuteronomy 31. Moses used the phrase when he was explaining to Joshua what would happen after he, that is Moses, died. And so he used the phrase then, "Be strong and of a good courage." And it's repeated throughout the book of Joshua, especially heavily in the first chapter or so. I don't want today to duplicate Mr. Giese's class, which I can't anyway, because there have only been three classes posted, and he's only in the middle of chapter 7 of Joshua, and there are 24 in the book. And I believe he's planning to cover the book of Judges, too, in this online edition. In the class he teaches at FI, I believe he teaches for 12 weeks, and he covers not only Joshua and Judges, but also 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings in some of the material there, too. What I have in mind is something much more directly connected to the Days of Unleavened Bread, which, as you know, continue until sunset this evening. Now, in some ways, it's a little hard to limit all of this just to the book of Joshua itself. Israel's example starts before him, and it continues after him. And that's what we're really looking at. But it's important to look at individuals, too, that have yielded themselves to God and allowed themselves to be instruments in his service. But as I already hinted, the earliest events in the book of Joshua are connected to this time of year. Turn to Joshua chapter 5, verses 10 to 12, and we'll see something that happened right after the Israelites crossed the Jordan River. In Joshua chapter 5 and verse 10, it says, "Now the children of Israel camped in Gilgal." Now you can check various Bible maps. Different ones have more or less detail, but you'll find that Gilgal is on the west side of the Jordan River. You probably know that in their journeys they swung around south of the area that they would later inherit, and they came up from the east side and then crossed back over, in effect, the Jordan River to the west. And you'll find Gilgal there, not very far from Jericho, in fact. So this is what's happening there. They kept the Passover, it says, on the 14th day of the month at twilight on the plains of Jericho. And they ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover, unleavened bread and parched grain on the very same day. Roasted grain, it says. Then the manna ceased on the day after they had eaten the produce of the land, and the children of Israel no longer had manna, but they ate the food of the land of Canaan that year. Now, there's something sort of hidden here. Because, in the fact, this passage is directly connected to this year in a specific way, 2021. In that, the pattern of the holy days was the same. There's a reason that we know that in this year, whatever the actual date of the year was, that Israel crossed the Jordan, it was a year in which the Passover fell on a Sabbath, just as it did this year, which of course means, as you know, we kept it on a Friday night. A week ago last night, we kept the Passover. A week ago tonight was the night to be much observed, inaugurating the beginning of the Days of Unleavened Bread. So just like this year, the same pattern of the Holy Days. The clue is in verse 11. They ate of the produce of the land on the day after the Passover. Unleavened bread and parched or roasted grain on the very same day. Why the stress? Why the stress? The day after the Passover, it's specifically recorded. And then the last part of the verse, on the very same day. It's stressed. Why? Well, it tells you what they were doing. They ate the produce of the land. This wasn't something they packed in their lunch buckets before they crossed the Jordan. They ate the produce of the land. On the very same day, the day after the Passover. Ask yourself a question. Knowing from your studies what you know, what had to happen in ancient Israel before they could eat the produce of the land any year? The wave sheaf offering had to be presented to God, right? You can find that. You may want to keep your place in Joshua here, but go back to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23 and verse 10. It says, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give to you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Eternal to be accepted on your behalf on the day after the Sabbath. The priest shall wave it." Then drop down to verse 14. "You shall eat neither bread, nor parched roasted grain, nor fresh grain, until the same day that you have brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwellings." And you notice what happens beginning on that same day, as we understand from the Hebrew. "And you shall count for yourselves from the day," or in Hebrew it gives a much more clear explanation of beginning on that day, or beginning with the day after the Sabbath, the day you brought the sheaf of the wave offering. "Seven Sabbaths shall be completed." And of course, we're into the instructions about how to calculate Pentecost. That's what's connected to the wave sheaf. So before they even munched on a handful of grain, after having crossed the Jordan, well, any year, but especially that year, they were to acknowledge God and His blessing first. So what did happen in according to Leviticus, we just read it in verses 10, 11, and 14. On the day after the Sabbath, which we would call a Sunday, or it's the first day of the week. What else would be important prophetically? It would be in the future from where they were back then. What else would be important prophetically about the wave sheaf? What other connection did it have? Well, it symbolized the future acceptance by God the Father of the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for our sins. And after that, the harvest could begin. You see the parallel spiritually? John 20 and verse 17 records the fact that Jesus told Mary Magdalene not to cling to Him. Or the King James Version says, "Do not touch me." And He explained why. "Because I have not yet ascended to my God and your God, my Father and your Father." It was on what day was that happening? It was on the wave sheaf day. It was on the Sunday, or the first day of the week that fell during the Days of Unleavened Bread. Now, in that year, because the first day had been on what we would call a Thursday, the wave sheaf day was the fourth day of Unleavened Bread. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. It was the fourth day. But it was the same day that the priest had waved the sheaf to be accepted by God before the harvest could begin. And of course, again, we know the symbolism. As soon as Christ's sacrifice was officially accepted by the Father, then the harvest for the family of God could begin. And the count toward Pentecost would start on that day. We know, as he told Mary, he had not yet ascended to his Father. That was the symbolism of the wave sheaf. That event was on the first day of the week during the days of unleavened bread in that year, AD 31. It was the fourth day that year. He had been resurrected, of course, the evening before at sunset, but he hadn't yet ascended. Here's the connection to this year. The only way the Israelites could have eaten any food of the land on the day after the Passover was if the Passover was on a Sabbath. Because the wave sheaf was waved on the first day of the week, a Sunday, that fell during the days of unleavened bread. Well, if it was waved on a Sunday and it was the day after Passover, what day was Passover? Sabbath. It was the Sabbath. And the day of the wave sheaf in those years, like this year, was also the first day of unleavened bread. And the fact that the sheaf was waved on that day, allowing them to eat any new produce, also means the count to Pentecost starts on that day. Now, many years ago, those of you who have been in the church a really long time, may recall a time when we kept Pentecost on Monday because we misunderstood the translation. We read it in English, and it said count from the day. Well, we meant, okay, I start, and then tomorrow's day one. That's not how the Hebrew is rendered. The Hebrew means count beginning on this day. And we came to see that almost 50 years ago now. What most don't know is we also corrected another mistake at the same time. Back then, we were also figuring, okay, when's the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread? All right. Then after that, the next day, we start counting to Pentecost. Well, you know, it's possible, as it is this year, for the first day of unleavened bread to be on a Sunday and the seventh day to be on a Sabbath. Well, when the seventh day is on a Sabbath, if you go to the next day, you're already outside the days of unleavened bread, aren't you? That doesn't match up with the symbolism of the wave sheaf. The wave sheaf is God accepting his son's sacrifice, and it was done during the days of unleavened bread. So not only years ago did we have the day wrong, we kept it one day too late. In years where the Passover fell on a Sabbath, we were keeping it a day and a week too late. We were starting our count a week too late. Which is why, for example, this year, if you look and you start thinking and counting, you'll say, oh, Pentecost, May 16th? Huh, that seemed like that 7 weeks went by fast. Well, it did because we've already counted 1 week. We've already counted a week. We've only got 6 weeks until Pentecost. 6 weeks tomorrow is Pentecost. And that was something we came to understand. Just a little bit of trivia for you. I don't think Mr. Giese actually covers that in his class. He kind of skipped over that part. But let's get back to the main focus today of Israel under Joshua. This was just to show that this was a year, this year, 2021, just like the year they crossed the Jordan with the Passover on a Sabbath. Are there unleavened lessons to learn from that time period? Well, brethren, I believe there are plenty of them. Stop and think for a moment about the man himself. What kind of person was Joshua? The first place his name is mentioned is in Exodus 17. The Egyptian army was dead, drowned in the Red Sea. We sang about it earlier. Good choice of hymns, Mr. Henderson. And I didn't even tip him off ahead of time. The Israelites had already complained about lack of food, which would start a pattern that lasted 40 years. As a result, they had their first experience with manna. Literally means, what is it? Which is the way it's translated in the New King James here in chapter 16 and verse 15. They said, they saw it, they said to one another, what is it? The Old King James, the authorized version, it says, it is manna. Well, and then you look it up and it says, that means, what is it? So this was the what's it they had every morning for 40 years. And Joshua's account, as we read, pointed out that it stopped as soon as they crossed and the wave sheaf day after they crossed the Jordan. They complained then about lack of water. Just when it seemed things could not get any worse, they did. Exodus 17, verse 8, "Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim." And here's the first mention, verse 9, "And Moses said to Joshua, 'Choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand.' So Joshua did as Moses said to him, and he fought with Amalek, and Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill." You know the story. When Moses' arms got tired, Aaron and Hur would hold them up, because when his arms fell, it appeared the Amalekites were winning. When he raised them again, then the Israelites were winning, victorious. So that's the story, the first time we see Joshua. He does what Moses tells him to do, and Amalek is defeated, verses 13 and 14. And you notice something really interesting in verse 14 about Joshua and about God. It says, "Then the Eternal said to Moses, 'Write this for a memorial in the book.'" Moses was keeping a record. He knew how to write. "And recount it in the hearing of Joshua." Interesting. They've only just crossed the river. They have not even come to some of those areas as carefully. They've crossed the river. They are away. The Israelites have been delivered. And as soon as they get clear of the Red Sea, as soon as they're clear of the Red Sea, here come the Amalekites. So they're not anywhere near to crossing the Jordan River yet. They're 40 years away, only they just don't know it yet. And God tells Moses, "I want you to write this down, and I want you to remind Joshua of it. I want you to recount it in the hearing of Joshua. And I will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." Now that didn't happen until much later, until the reign of King Saul. But Joshua is singled out. He is acknowledged as dependable and trustworthy and brave and strong and courageous. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like a lesson for us? But there's much more to his story than that. Joshua was also one of the 12 spies sent by Moses to forge on ahead into the promised land before the nation moved in. That's in Numbers 13. He was of the tribe of Ephraim, it says. Ephraim, of course, being the younger son of Joseph. Caleb was from the tribe of Judah. Those are listed in Numbers 13, along with all the other spies. There was another spy from Joseph, from the tribe of Manasseh, a man by the name of Gadai. But the 12 spies, only Joshua and Caleb were faithful. The other 10 misrepresented what they'd seen. There were no Levites among the 12. 2 from Joseph, none from Levi. We know the story that only Caleb and Joshua were faithful. That's recounted in Numbers 13 and 14. But think about what this means about Joshua and apply it to your life and mine right now. Have you or I ever had to suffer because of somebody else's foolishness or sin? Has someone else's sin ever made you sorrowful? I suspect so. We are not islands to ourselves. Did you ever chafe under that? Did you ever cry out to God, "Why did you allow that? I didn't do anything wrong." In some ways, that was partially the message of the book of Job that we heard in a sermon by Mr. Pavlik here a week ago. Did you ever complain to God, "That's just not fair. I don't understand"? What about Joshua? Did he or Caleb deserve to wander 40 years in the desert? No, they didn't. They reported truthfully. They urged the people to trust God. They said, "We are well able to overcome them. God's on our side. Don't you remember what he's done?" And then Joshua maybe could have gone all the way back to crossing the Red Sea and the battle against the Amalekites, where Moses had to have his arms held up by Aaron and Hur. And Joshua was out there in front of the army. They didn't deserve that, but they did wander 40 years in the desert. Why? Because the other 10 spies lied, and because the people listened to the liars and lost heart. Remember that when the plagues began to rain down on Egypt, the first four also impacted the Israelites. Beginning with the fifth plague, God began to protect Israel from the plagues. There are lessons, brethren, to learn from that. Maybe we don't think of that kind of thing as a Days of Unleavened Bread lesson, but it can be. Sin is tough to remove in ourselves, and it is impossible to remove it from others. Tough to remove from ourselves, as Mr. Slagle talked about in his sermonette today. Impossible to remove from others. And yet, sometimes you and I are impacted by the sins of others. That's just not easy to understand or accept, but it's part of life, and it always has been. There's something that struck me as I was going through Hebrews the other day, in Hebrews chapter 12. Initially, it seems unrelated, but then I thought, how interesting, the similarity of names. In Hebrews chapter 12, the first three verses, it's talking about Jesus Christ. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, this follows right after the faith chapter, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him who endured such hostility from sinners against himself. Was Jesus impacted by the sins of others? To the extreme nth degree, he died for the sins of others because he had none. Lest you become weary and discouraged in your soul. So it does tie in to the lesson. And there's another interesting tie-in. Perhaps you've thought about it already. What is the name Joshua if it's translated into Greek? It is Jesus in Greek. It's the same name. Same name. And I thought, how interesting. Obviously, this is speaking of Jesus Christ, the Messiah, our Savior. But there are overtones here of another man who lived earlier in that sense, although Jesus appeared to Abraham, we know, even long before Joshua was ever born. A name that was very much the same, but in a different language. Did Joshua complain? Did he murmur about his fate? Well, he had some weak moments, and we'll find one a bit later in the sermon. But that wasn't the tenor of his life. That doesn't describe the man. There are a couple of verses that do. Numbers chapter 27 is one of them. Numbers chapter 27. Beginning in verse 15, it says, Then Moses spoke to the Eternal, saying, Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation. Now this is toward the end of the book of Numbers. This is very close to the end of Moses' life, because Deuteronomy is basically a recounting of the history of Israel up to that point. So as far as historically, the end of Numbers and the end of Deuteronomy are dealing with the same time period. So Moses is basically praying and asking God's help, knowing he has not that much longer to live. Let the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, set a man over the congregation who may go out before them and go in before them, who may lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Eternal may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. And what did God tell him? The Lord said to Moses, Take Joshua, the son of Nun, with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Set him before Eleazar the priest and all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight. Install him into your office, Moses. This is the man that I choose to replace you. That's what God thought of Joshua. Deuteronomy 34, as I've said, the end of these two books is really the same time period. Deuteronomy 34, we find the account of the death of Moses. And after he died, verse 5, God buried him so that no one would know where his grave was. We find hints in the New Testament that perhaps Satan was actually trying to have people discover Moses' grave and body so that they would worship it. And God specifically hid that. In verse 5, and the children of Israel, verse 8, and the children of Israel wept for Moses in the plains of Moab 30 days. So the days of weeping and mourning for Moses ended. Now, verse 9, Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the children of Israel heeded him and did as the Lord had commanded Moses. So Joshua, in God's eyes and the way he set him before the Israelites, was to be viewed in much the same way Moses was. It's quite a story. There is no direct mention of him in the faith chapter of Hebrews 11. That is of interest too. Hebrews 11 does not mention Joshua by name. Interestingly enough, it does mention another name from exactly the same time period. And we'll see some lessons about that too. But there are oblique references in Hebrews 11. It says in verse 30, by faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they were encircled for 7 days. Interesting, it's not even talking about any human being in this verse. It says, the walls of Jericho fell down after they, the walls, were encircled for 7 days. Well, who did the encircling? Well, the Israelite army. And who was in charge of Israel back then? Joshua was. The writer of Hebrews here, we think traditionally described to be Paul, says, he starts describing Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, etc., etc., verse 32. Verse 33, who through faith subdued kingdoms, worked righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, etc., etc. Notice you come down to verse 37, it says, they wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, afflicted, tormented. They wandered in deserts and mountains, verse 38. That applied to Joshua too. He was part of the 40 years of wandering. Joshua was the one who relayed the instructions from God about Jericho, and the people in that instance at least obeyed, all except one man. More on that later. And the walls of Jericho fell down. God fought the battle for them. Let's look more directly into the story of Joshua. Go back to Joshua chapter 2. We find in verse 1, now Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, go and view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. Now, this is an interesting description. And you're going to find that Rahab is mentioned several places in the Bible. In fact, she's mentioned twice in the New Testament. We just kind of skipped over it right where we were. She is mentioned in Hebrews 11. Joshua is not, but Rahab is. It's kind of interesting. Now, as Mr. Giese pointed out, he said when he got to this point in the class, he said, these two men did not go to her house because of her profession. Thought that was worthwhile noting. He said, if you are trying to fly under the radar, where can you go where strangers would not be out of place? Where people, in one sense, are taking pains to hide their identity. Right there. Thought that was interesting. It's speculation, but he said He suggests it was a place where strangers wouldn't be out of place. And they wouldn't stand out. Something was going on, though, in the mind of this unusual woman that only God knew, and he directed these things. He directed the men there. Yes, she lied to the authorities. She did not yet understand the way of God fully. She did not yet embrace that new way of life. But clearly God was working with her, even though she, as I said, didn't understand completely. But as you drop down to verse 9 and 10 and 11, she's talking to these men whom she has hidden. And she says, I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, what you did to the two kings of the Amorites on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you destroyed utterly. As soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. That's a remarkable statement from a woman from a pagan culture with many gods. At a time when they tended to believe that gods only had power in the lands in which they were worshipped. They were kind of strange views they had of those gods. Clearly God's doing something in her life. And so before we criticize her too much, think of what she was risking. And frankly, her response to what she could see about Israel and Israel's God was more respectful and responsive and yielded than that of many of the native-born Israelites who griped and complained every time they ran short of food or water. This woman says, I am willing to stick my neck out. I am willing to trust my life and the life of my family to depend on your God, because it's obvious from what we've heard that he is God. He's not like the gods with a small g that our people talk about. He's something incredibly special. She was risking a lot. Later, when the city fell, and God spared her and her family in chapter 6 of Joshua, she is still referred to twice in Joshua 6 by the same phrase. Joshua 6, verse 17. The city shall be doomed by the Lord to destruction, it and all who are in it. Only Rahab the harlot shall live, she and all who are with her in her house, because she hid the messengers that we sent. In verse 25. Joshua spared Rahab the harlot, her father's household, all that she had. So she dwells in Israel to this day, because she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Now some speculations, and I'm not sure if it goes as far even as traditions, but some speculations speculate that perhaps she married one of those spies. That would make a nice Hallmark romance story, wouldn't it? Who knows? I guess we'll find out in the future. But she's mentioned twice in the New Testament, in Hebrews 11:31, which we didn't read, skipped over, and in James 2:25. You want to guess how she's identified in both those verses? Both times she is identified as Rahab the harlot. That seems strange to us, doesn't it? Why not Rahab the spy saver? Or Rahab the repentant? Has a nice ring to it, kind of alliterative, Rahab the repentant. Or Rahab the courageous? How would we like it if we were mentioned by name in the Bible only by adding in our most embarrassing sin in the description? Why did God have it recorded this way? Well, I'll tell you. I don't know. Perhaps he wanted in the record that his people would read and study for hundreds, even thousands of years, to emphasize what faith in him and in his power and in his forgiveness could accomplish in a person's life. But one thing we know, Rahab is actually mentioned by name in the faith chapter, even when Joshua is not. That's what I mean when I say read with curiosity. And look for reasons. Both times that she's mentioned in the New Testament, you know what's emphasized about her? Her faith. So Rahab the faithful, I suspect, may be the way she's known in the family of God in the future. Rahab the faithful. She's mentioned in the faith chapter, Hebrews 11:31, and in James's explanation that our faith is demonstrated by our works in the book of James, chapter 2. Both times, what is focused on is her faith. Either way, she comes up, as they say, smelling like roses. Can we learn from her example, boldly go forward to obey God no matter what the consequences might seem to be? What about other lessons? Back in Joshua chapter 3 now. Joshua 3. Verse 11. They are just about to cross the Jordan. In Joshua 3 and verse 7, the Lord said to Joshua, "This day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that as I was with Moses, so I will be with you. You shall command the priests who bear the Ark of the Covenant, saying, 'When you have come to the edge of the water of the Jordan, you shall stand in the Jordan.'" It didn't say, "Wait for me to create a strong wind and split the Jordan like I did the Red Sea." He says, "When you get to the Jordan, carrying the Ark, I want you to wade in." Say what? So Joshua said to the children of Israel, "Come here and hear the words of the Lord your God. By this you shall know that the living God is among you, and that he will without fail drive out from before you the Canaanites, Hittites, Hivites, Perizzites, Girgashites, Amorites, Jebusites. Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth," look at that term, "is crossing over before you into the Jordan. But it was being carried by priests. It didn't fly. Men had to carry it. Now therefore take for yourselves 12 men from the tribes of Israel, one man from every tribe. And it shall come to pass, as soon as the soles of the feet of the priests who bear the ark of the Eternal, the Lord of all the earth, when they step into the water, when those feet shall rest in the waters of the Jordan, then the waters of the Jordan shall be cut off, the waters that come down from upstream, and they shall stand as a heap. That's great as long as you're not a priest carrying a burden." So it was when the people set out from their camp to cross over the Jordan with the priests bearing the Ark of the Covenant. As those who bore the ark came to the Jordan, and the feet of the priests who bore the ark dipped in the edge of the water. This wasn't a trickle during off season, for the Jordan overflows all its banks during the whole time of harvest, that the waters which came down from upstream stood still and rose in a heap very far away at Adam, the city beside Zaratan. So the waters that went down into the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, failed and were cut off, and the people crossed over opposite Jericho. Then the priests who bore the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the midst of the Jordan, and all Israel crossed over on dry ground until all the people had crossed completely over the Jordan. You ever stood in the ocean, sandy shore, and have the waves come in? You ever tried to just stand there for a while and stay on top of the sand? Good luck with that. As the waves come in and then it washes back out again, what happens to your feet? They start sinking into the sand. If you were 6 foot one, sound like somebody I know, well, I used to be, I'm not sure now, but after standing there for 15 minutes, I'm about 5 foot three. Because you start sinking. What must it have been like for the priests? Mr. Giese spent some time in his class about this lesson. If you are a priest stepping into a flood-swollen river carrying a burden, what must it have been like? It required what? Faith. Faith. That's really an overriding message of the entire book of Joshua. And in the later words of James, showing your faith by your works. Drop down into chapter 4, verse 10. So the priests who bore the ark stood in the midst of the Jordan until everything was finished that the Lord had commanded Joshua to speak to the people. According to all that Moses had commanded Joshua, and the people hurried and crossed over. Then it came to pass, when all the people had completely crossed over, that the ark of the Lord and the priests crossed over in the presence of the people. The men of Reuben, the men of Gad, half the tribe of Manasseh crossed over armed. You know the story, how 2.5 tribes had asked for their land east of the Jordan and so on. Command the priests, verse 16, who bear the ark of the testimony, Joshua was told, to come up from the Jordan. Joshua therefore commanded the priests, saying, come up from the Jordan. And it came to pass, when the priests who bore the ark of the covenant of the Lord had come from the midst of the Jordan, and the soles of the priests' feet touched the dry land, that the waters of the Jordan returned to their place and overflowed all its banks as before. What would it have been like? What would the sound have been like? What if you're watching all those backed up, stacking higher and higher and higher and higher, upstream waters of the Jordan, and you're thinking, okay, guys, catch your breath, because as soon as we hit the shore, run for it. Because when the waters are unleashed, as if somebody opened the sluice gates on a dam, I'm sure you could just see them frothing and boiling and all of a sudden bearing down on you again. That must have been quite the thing. Not perhaps quite like the Red Sea, but awfully close. Awfully close. Especially if you were a priest who was supposed to carry the ark. Faith. Faith. What was the lesson? Well, last part of the chapter 4, the people came up from the Jordan, verse 19, on the 10th day of the first month. They camped in Gilgal on the east border of Jericho. We're working up to where we already looked at, coming up to the Passover, 10th of the first month in this case. They camped in Gilgal, the east border of Jericho. They took the 12 stones they'd taken out of the river. When your children ask their fathers in time to come, saying, what are these stones? You'll let them know Israel crossed over this Jordan on dry land in flood season. He dried up the waters of the Jordan before you until you crossed over, just as he did to the Red Sea. And the reason that all the peoples of the earth may know the hand of the Eternal, that it is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. Well, sadly, the Israelites didn't. Will we? Can we learn that lesson from Israel under Joshua? The next chapter records another incident. We find that the first three verses record the fact that during the 40 years wandering in the wilderness, none of the boy babies had been circumcised, which was supposed to occur on the eighth day of life, and it was symbolically calling to mind the covenant God made with Abraham. It was removed as a physical requirement in the New Testament in the early church at the great conference in Acts 15. But before that, it was expected. And even those peoples who were not Israelite who wanted to join themselves to the nation, the males were required to undergo this ritual. Now, let me ask you a question, as Mr. Giese did. You're getting ready to have your first big battle after crossing the Jordan, and your entire army is on sick leave. I won't explain any further. But what kind of a lesson is required? Faith. It isn't until chapter 6 that God speaks to Joshua and says, here's the way you're going to attack Jericho. First of all, though, this symbol of the covenant has to be taken care of. It hasn't happened for 40 years. It was serious in those days. It was a sign of the covenant God made with Abraham. What's the lesson for us? Well, I think it's obvious. Before we enter the promised land, the kingdom of God, we will be required to have what Paul called a circumcised heart. As he told his readers in his letters that he wrote, circumcision is of the heart. It reveals a yielded attitude toward God. And before we enter his family as his children, that will be required. There's an analogy there. You can go to the tail end of the New Testament, as close to the end as you can get. In chapter 22 of Revelation, in verse 12, I'll just read these words to you. Behold, verse 12, Revelation 22, I'm coming quickly. My reward is with me to give to everyone according to his work. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end, the first and the last. Blessed are those who do his commandments, that they may have the right to the tree of life and enter through the gates into the city. Outside are dogs and sorcerers, sexually immoral, murderers, idolaters, whoever loves and practices a lie. Verse 18, I testify to everyone who hears the words of the prophecy of this book. If anyone adds to these things, God will add to him the plagues that are written in this book. And if anyone takes away, verse 19, from the words of the book of this prophecy, God will take away his part from the book of life, from the holy city, and from the things which are written in this book. There are only two more verses in the entire Bible after those words. And those two verses do not change the picture. Obedience is required. A yielded heart is required. Giving ourselves over to be slaves of sin disqualifies us from God's family. Big lessons. Big lessons. Are our names written in the book of life? Do we have the yielded heart that God must see in us? More lessons. The end of Joshua chapter 5. Joshua, it says, verse 13, it came to pass, but when he was by Jericho, he lifted his eyes and he looked. And a man stood opposite him with his sword drawn in his hand. And the man, the word man is capitalized. And Joshua went to him and said, are you for us or are you for our adversaries? It was almost like a sentry saying, halt, who goes there? Here's the answer. No. That didn't answer the question. But he's about to get an answer. As commander of the army of the eternal, I have now come. And Joshua fell on his face to the earth and worshipped. And he said to him, what does my Lord say to his servant? You know, we find in the book of Revelation that even the angels forbid humans to worship them. We know who this was. Then the commander of the eternal's army said to Joshua, take your sandal off your foot. Sound familiar? For the place where you stand is holy. And Joshua did so. And at that point, God gives him the details. The one who became Jesus Christ gives him the details of how they will conquer Jericho. Or maybe I should say how God would conquer Jericho. The instructions are rather interesting as you read through Joshua 6. Basically, the instructions are, okay, here's what you do. You take the men of war. And the first day, everybody is absolutely quiet, not a whisper. You take the priests with you, seven priests, and they'll have seven trumpets of ram's horns, the shofar, shofarim. And they'll blow the horns, but otherwise everybody's quiet. 6 days you do this, march around the city. The seventh day, they march around seven times. And then the priests blow the trumpets and everyone shouts. When the long blast sounds from the ram's horn, when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people shall go up every man straight before him. How would you react if you were given those instructions? Hear your battle plan. Everybody, shut up. March around the city once. The priests are tooting on their horns. You don't say a word. You do it 6 days in a row. Nobody says anything. You do it seven times on the seventh day. You yell and blow your horns and the walls fall down flat. And we win? How would you react to those instructions? You know what Joshua did? He said, yes, Lord. Yes, sir. Yes, commander of the army of the eternal. And for once in their history, we don't see murmuring or complaining, and it happens just as God said it would. What about the kingdoms of this world that John tells us about in Revelation 11:15? Is there some similarity to six plagues and then a seventh plague and then the kingdoms of this world becoming the kingdoms of the Lord our Christ? I don't know. Speculation. You know, actually, as you go back to Joshua, there was a problem with the conquest of Jericho, but it wasn't with the nation. It was with one man. Joshua 7 and verse 1, the children of Israel committed a trespass regarding the accursed things, for Achan, the son of Carmi, the son of Zabdi, the son of Zerah of the tribe of Judah, took of the accursed things. So the anger of the Eternal burned against the children of Israel. One man. But look at what it led to. Verses 2, 3, 4, and 5, a completely unexpected rout at the hands of the men of Ai, when they only sent up 3,000 of their army and 36 Israelites died because of the sin of one man. And Joshua, in one of the rare instances, loses a grip on reality. Verse 6, Joshua tore his clothes and he fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord till evening. He and the elders of Israel, they put dust on their heads. And Joshua said, "Alas, Lord God, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all?" Doesn't sound like Joshua, does it? Sounds like the complaining Israelites. "To deliver us to the hand of the Amorites, to destroy us? Oh, that we'd been content and dwelt on the other side of the Jordan." But that's not what God wanted. "Lord, what shall I say when Israel turns its back before its enemies? The Canaanites, all the inhabitants of the land, will hear it, surround us, and cut off our name. Then what will you do for your great name?" That's not the way God wanted to have Joshua talk to him. You know what he said to him? Look at verse 10. The Lord said to Joshua, "Get up." I imagine he spoke it rather sharply. "Get up, Joshua. What are you doing lying there on your face? Israel has sinned. That's the problem." And yet another lesson we can learn, brethren, from the book of Joshua. After all that God had done for them, after all the encouragement, after he had met the commander of the army of the Eternal face to face, Joshua almost seems to be blaming God for what happened. And Joshua is corrected rather sharply. God says, "Get up! What are you doing flat on your face?" Have you or I ever done that? Wail to God about something we couldn't understand? Maybe even hinted, "Well, that's not the way I would have done it." I don't think those are very good words to say to God. God's reaction with Joshua is recorded for a lesson for us, I believe. Basically, he said, "Joshua, there is sin here, and until it is removed, my presence and my help are gone." In the process to reveal the problem, we find that the offender was stoned to death, and then later his body was burned, and his family was executed too. And you might think, well, why? They lived in tents. He had stolen masses of booty, of silver and gold, of valuable apparel. Where do you hide it? In the attic? Well, you bury it under the ground, under your tent, I guess. How could the family not have known? In legal or criminal terms, that's called becoming an accessory after the fact. In any case, Achan had every opportunity to come forward when he saw what was happening, and he didn't. And neither did his family members. Some important lessons here, too. Joshua reacted in a very uncharacteristic way. He was human. He seemed to lose courage and lose heart and even almost blame God, but it was an opportunity to learn. And brethren, for us too, do we see how much even one person's sin can impact so many people around him or around her? Remember Paul's letter to Corinth in the New Testament, the man living in sin with his stepmother? Review 1 Corinthians 5 sometime. It had corrupted the entire congregation. Their attitudes were twisted. they were congratulating themselves on their tolerance for something that was sinful conduct ongoing in their midst. And Paul had to say, this is not right. The man should be removed from fellowship unless or until he changes and repents, which he did. And that was the good part. And you guessed it. When was 1 Corinthians written, do we think? During the days of unleavened bread. In Joshua's time and in the case of Achan, it even caused the death, like I said, of 36 men in the first battle. And in the total disheartening of the entire nation, including Joshua. We are our brother's keeper in so many ways. How about another lesson? Chapter 9. Came to pass when all the kings, verse 1, who were on this side of the Jordan, in the hills and in the lowland and in all the coasts of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite, all the Ites, they gathered together to fight with Joshua and Israel with one accord or one mouth or one agreement. But when the inhabitants of Gibeah heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, now Gibeah was a city not very far away. There were actually four of them we find in verse 17. Gibeon, Shepherah, Beeroth, and Kiriath-Jearim. When they heard what Joshua had done, they worked craftily and went and pretended to be ambassadors, or they acted as envoys, the margin says. They took old sacks on their donkeys, old wineskins torn and mended, old and patched sandals on their feet, old garments on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry and moldy. And they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and pretended they'd been traveling for days and days and days. And they said, "We've come from a far country. Now, therefore, make a covenant or a treaty with us." The men of Israel said, "Perhaps you dwell among us. How can we make a covenant among you or with you?" But they told Joshua, "We are your servants." And Joshua said to them, "Who are you and where do you come from?" Please note that phrase, "We are your servants," what eventually happened to them. So they said, "Well, from a very far country your servants have come." It sounds like a scam to me, doesn't it to you? You know when your phone rings and the caller ID says spam risk? I think that's what's going on here. "Because of the name of the Lord your God, we've heard of his fame and all that he did in Egypt, all that he did to the two kings, you know, Sihon, Og, etc. Therefore, our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions with you for the journey, go to meet them and say, we are your servants, make a covenant with us.'" Then they get into specifics. "This bread of ours we took hot for our provision from our houses on the day we departed to come to you. Look, it's dry and moldy. These wineskins which we filled were new. And see, they're torn. And these our garments and our sandals have become old because of the very long journey." Then the men of Israel took some of their provisions, but they didn't ask counsel of the Eternal. They examined the goods. They forgot one critically important step. So Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the rulers of the congregation swore to them. And it happened at the end of 3 days, after they'd made a covenant with them, they heard that they were their neighbors who dwelt near them. And then the children of Israel journeyed and came to their cities on the third day. Their cities were Gibeon, Shepherah, Beeroth, and Kiriath-Jearim. But the children of Israel did not attack them, because the rulers of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord God of Israel, and all the congregation complained against the rulers. We're not told why. And they were told, "Look, we made a deal." We made a deal. Some important lessons to learn here. Now, the Gibeonites, for what it's worth, did not historically prove to be a problem for Israel. We even find references later, and much later, in the days of Nehemiah, in Nehemiah 3 and verse 7 and Nehemiah 7 and verse 25, that lead us to believe they actually became fully assimilated within the nation of Israel. They even had responsibilities they carried out in the time of the restructuring in Jerusalem under Nehemiah. On the other hand, having made a covenant with them, the Israelites from that point on were compelled to defend them. When you go on into Joshua 10, which I won't go into now, the story of Joshua's long day, the reason that day was so long is that they were pursuing the enemies who had tried to attack the Gibeonites. They were required to defend and protect these people they'd made a deal with. And in fact, You find later, much later in 2 Samuel 21, when Saul went back on that agreement, God punished the entire nation. You know, there's a proverb that says, blessed are those who swear to their own hurt and refuse to change. Proverbs 15 and verse 4. So they were required to keep their word, and they had another lesson to learn. Reading through later, if you read through the whole book of Judges, you'll find numerous references to other peoples that the Israelites either couldn't or didn't drive out, and in most cases it became a stumbling block because of the false gods and the idol worship those nations practice. For whatever reason, the Gibeonites did not appear to be part of that. Can we learn lessons from that? Do we understand that drawing too close to worldly practices can distance us from God? You know the pattern about 2 Corinthians 6, about come out from among them and be you separate. James says something in his book in James chapter 4. James chapter 4, I'll read from the J.B. Phillips translation of the New Testament in modern English. It says, you are like unfaithful wives, flirting with the glamour of this world, never realizing that to be the world's lover means becoming the enemy of God. Anyone who deliberately chooses to be the world's friend is thereby making himself God's enemy. James 4 and verse 4. There's one last lesson I'd like to point us to on this last day of unleavened bread in 2021. And that lesson is how we say goodbye to this life. I remember a friend of mine in the ministry who talked about his dad, who died a number of years ago after serving God for decades. And my friend in the ministry said, my dad taught us how to live and he taught us how to die. So did Joshua. Read the entire chapter of Joshua 23 sometime. It's very moving. It details the account of when Joshua had gotten old. The land was basically subdued. And in Joshua 23:14, behold, this day I am going the way of all the earth, Joshua says. And you know in all your hearts and in all your souls that not one thing has failed of all the good things which the Lord your God spoke concerning you. All have come to pass for you, not one word of them has failed. He upheld God. It shall come to pass that as all the good things have come upon you, which the Lord your God promised you, so he will bring unto you all harmful things until he has destroyed you, if you don't obey him, when you've transgressed his covenant, verse 16, which he commanded you, and have gone and served other gods, and bowed down to them, then his anger will burn against you, and you shall perish quickly from the good land which he has given you. He too warned them. And you know the famous statement, chapter 24, verses 14 and 15. Joshua, now therefore fear the eternal. Joshua 24, 14. Serve him in sincerity and in truth. Put away the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river and in Egypt. Serve the eternal. And if it seems evil to you to serve him, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Whether the gods which your fathers served on the other side of the river, the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve the eternal. That, in a nutshell, is Joshua. His legacy, we find in verses 29 and 30 and 31 of the same chapter, Joshua 24, 31, Israel served the eternal all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had known all the works of the Eternal which he had done for Israel. Three generations it took for them to drift away. His influence was so strong that even after he was dead, those who remembered his example held fast. Quite a man. Quite a man. Here you and I are on the last day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread 2021. Just as we all knew at the beginning of it, as we sat down to a sumptuous meal with friends a week ago tonight, on the night to be much observed, it has flown past. In a few more hours, the symbolism of leaven representing sin no longer applies physically. But the lessons have to stay with us. The lessons from ancient Israel did not end when Moses died. They continued under the leadership of another remarkable man, Joshua, the son of Nun. What about us? How's the conquest going in your life and mine? Have we truly driven out the pagan nations in our path? Sins in this case, not people. Have we tended to coexist with sin? Do we live as if a little leaven is okay? Or do we remember Paul's words, "Don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump?" So that, in a nutshell, is one message I believe we can take from the book of Joshua. And the instruction to us remains as it was to him from Joshua 1 and verse 9. Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Speaking in terms of annual holy days, 6 weeks from tomorrow is Pentecost.